Welcome to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jennifer Winstall.
And I'm Leslie Kinchlow.
We're with the Winstall Kinchlow team in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can reach us at jennifer.winstall@ubs.com. We are financial advisors with UBS, one of the largest wealth managers in the world.
We are so excited to have meaningful conversations with a variety of guests. We'll be exploring their passions in business, entrepreneurship, and philanthropy.
Our mission is to bring purpose to life beyond the numbers. Welcome back to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We're excited today to talk about data centers, something we're reading and hearing about pretty much on a daily basis now. So let me introduce our guests. We've got Jay Dobson, who's a U.S. equity strategist with UBS covering energy and utilities, as well as Nathaniel Gable, who's a U.S. equity sector strategist as well, covering industrials and materials, both with UBS Chief Investment Office. So welcome to the two of you.
Thank you for having us.
Really appreciate
Absolutely. And our third guest, Bridget Grant, local here in Charlotte, North Carolina, who works with Morvin Allen, and she is a land use and zone consultant. So we're excited to have Bridget as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bridget. Let's jump right into the conversation. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about data centers and what is driving this unprecedented demand for data centers today. I thought we'd start with you, Nathaniel, and we have some questions teed up for Bridget as well, but let's get the conversation started.
Looking forward to it.
So what is driving this unprecedented demand?
Sure. So, you know, obviously there have been data centers for decades, but what we're seeing today really began with the launch of ChatGPT almost on the dot in November of 2022. Before that, for basically 3 or 4 years, we were building around $8 billion to $10 billion worth of U.S. data center capacity per year. But after ChatGPT came out, you can look at the graph of data center construction values. It just turns into a hockey stick. And it surges well above $30 billion. So, you know, that GPT moment really kicked off a global arms race to advance these AI models, you know, definitely for commercial use, but also increasingly for national security purposes. And we've seen all these big tech companies, the hyperscalers, pledge hundreds of billions of dollars of annual spending on data centers to train AI models, but also to respond to user inquiries. And so, you know, those giant AI training facilities are probably what we think of first. These are, call it 100 megawatts to 1 gigawatt plus. You know, Jay can do a better job of explaining a gigawatt, but it's essentially like powering a million US homes. And these are typically built in the remote locations where power is cheap and available, and speed and latency are less of a concern. But then there's what's called the AI inference pipeline. So this is what helps you when you make a query of the AI model. And those are built closer to metro areas in often these co-location environments where managing the speed of answering your query is more important. So total demand, I'd say, kind of hard to pin down, but we're tracking some 200 gigawatts of data center project announcements. And, you know, not all of that is practical. We need to adjust for all kinds of bottlenecks, but we think maybe 75 to 95 gigawatts are possible over the next few years. There are about 16 gigawatts under active construction. But to really put this in perspective, how much we can actually build, we only built 6 gigawatts in 2024 and only 7 in 2025. So very large pipeline of demand here.
I mean, the numbers are incredible when you shared that with us earlier. I think most people would be surprised at how few data centers are actually being built in the United States on an annual basis.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Yeah, we had heard there were something like 11,000 data centers in the world today, and maybe half of those here in the United States. Does that sound right to you?
Ah, that does sound about right. You know, it's been pretty interesting. It used to be many years ago, so call it 2010, it was a pretty even balance among the three regions, Americas, Europe, Asia. And now the U.S. represents about 52% of all data centers in the world. So the U.S. is clearly gaining ground relative to everybody else, but the whole pie is growing very quickly.
So how much of that do you think is truly AI versus the traditional data compute need?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal question. And I think it's really changing in real time. If we look at the distribution of new data center builds by computing capacity, it heavily skews toward AI infrastructure. Call it 60 to 70% is for AI. Traditional cloud, maybe 15 to 20% of new capacity. And that's what you used to see with database and web applications and software as a service, growing much more slowly in, you know, sort of a single digit range. And then the remainder is co-location and multi-tenant. But, you know, those are tending to be grabbed and leased immediately by hyperscalers or neo clouds or other customers looking for capacity. That old fashioned enterprise on-premise computing power is, there's almost no standalone enterprise data centers being built today. But it's really changed massively. Even just going back to 2018, you know, it was 56% enterprise, 20% hyperscale, 20-something percent colocation. So, you know, I think by the end of the decade, probably two-thirds of data center capacity will skew toward those big hyperscale players who are looking for significant power and compute density.
Jay, any additional comments to complement Nathaniel's?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we're seeing a tremendous amount of AI demand. I definitely want at some point to talk about supply because, you know, really this is where it's all going to come down to. But maybe to put one of the numbers that Nathaniel just mentioned in context, you know, 200 gigawatts sounds like a lot, but we'd say 200 of what? If you look at the U.S. system, the U.S. electric system is about 1,200 gigawatts of capacity right now. So we're talking 16% of that. You might say, wow, that's really small. But again, you know, as Nathaniel was saying, we haven't built a lot of supply, you know, recently, largely because demand hasn't been growing. I mean, you know, really, I've been doing this about 35 years, and this AI demand growth is just astounding to me. It's nothing I've seen in my career. And really, you would have to go back to the 1950s and 1960s in the U.S. when you saw the advent of air conditioning and electric appliances to get anything close to this. And that, to me, is the challenge, that all of these AI data centers want power. They want power as fast as possible. I would argue that is the top five or six priorities each of these data centers is looking for, and they're shopping around the country to try and find where they can get it.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to kind of pull this back locally into what's happening in Charlotte. And Bridget, we're gonna turn the mic to you. If we want to talk about demand and supply, and but what's happening locally? Currently, there's a moratorium in Charlotte to not build data centers, right?
That's short term, 150 days.
150 days. Okay. So can you walk us through kind of the current landscape in this region and what you're seeing?
We're seeing what I would call a high level of kick the tires, people trying to find sites anywhere that they can. Number one, that already allowed data centers as a permitted use. To their point about this technology is changing so quickly, data centers aren't even defined in a lot of zoning ordinances. Municipalities aren't necessarily prepared for the amount of water or energy, how the technology has evolved, and how those systems can fit into our existing land use pattern. It's not necessarily that there's a shortage of land available to do these types of systems. It's figuring out the best and most appropriate land, the highest and best use for where they need to go.
So are there some, I mean, we've been reading about, there's some little mini versions of this, right, that pop up around town where maybe they are getting through.
If they've already got zoning, that's probably the number one thing that developers are looking for. They really want to know that there's power available and that there's certainty on the process. So if the site is already zoned appropriately with an industrial district zoning on it,
yes,
and that use already allows a data center, municipalities can't weigh into whether or not the use is permitted. So you're seeing some pop up already because they exist, the zoning exists for them. And then there are some others that are in buildings in downtown Charlotte or other these that people don't even realize have already been there for decades.
This is the co-location, right, that Nathaniel talked about. Okay. Yep.
Even what you would refer to as the data centers where our banking information is held, where our healthcare information is held, we would historically have referred to those as data centers. It was just more for storing of data rather than the AI processing.
So how do you feel Charlotte is kind of ranking or stacking against the rest of the U.S.? And then we'll have Nathaniel and Jay kind of share what they're hearing from Texas and other states.
I think we're still really on the front, the beginning mm-hmm. of the race. Mm-hmm. We're just now pausing to see how we can change our regulations. There are actually some current state laws that prohibit any municipality from downzoning. So if you're allowed to have data centers already in North Carolina, you can't legally, a municipality can't downzone and take that right away from you. Mm-hmm. What Charlotte's doing is really just pausing to see if there are other ways they can right-size the request, mm-hmm. do environmental considerations, and use other tools other than zoning to see if there's the best way to handle the size and scale.
Now, Nathaniel and Jay, is that consistent with what you're hearing in other states? Or, you know, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I would say generally, and then I'll let Nathaniel weigh in. You know, I'd say there's a bit, I wouldn't necessarily say moratoriums, though, you know, my little 2 cents on this is I don't know that moratoriums are great policy. I'm glad this one's only 150 days, but they don't tend to be great sort of policies. But we are seeing some backlash across the country. It depends, you know, places like Texas, you know, and even sort of the Southeast, you know, sort of a little more central, Louisiana, Mississippi are sort of arms wide open to these data centers. Other sort of more urban areas or suburban areas tend to be less so. But I'd say overall, it's, as Bridget was saying, it's the land use. But once you even get past the land use, it's, you know, can you connect such a large load? I mean, even if you're zoned for something, you know, if we were talking 5 years ago and we said, hey, what do you think is a large load? That would have been like 100 megawatts, 150 megawatts. And now, you know, if you look in Louisiana, you know, they're doing a 5 gigawatt, so 5,000 megawatt data center. I mean, it pales in comparison to, you know, sort of what we're seeing today. And you then need the interconnection there. So, you know, the zoning, maybe, yeah, you've got power and you've got power up to 35 megawatts. And now this data center is saying, well, I need, you know, 10 times that. So I think that's the first thing. And then, of course, I think the other issue is, and we're hearing this nationally, is just, well, what's it going to do to my power prices? What is it going to do, you know, to you know, local residential and commercial power prices? And that's where you've seen the White House get involved. You've seen, you know, state and federal regulators and legislators get involved and say, you know, that the data centers need to pay their fair share, which I think by and large, at least at the hyperscale level, they are very willing to do. They don't want to go to a community, invest hundreds of billions of dollars and have the community dislike them. That doesn't work for anybody, but they do, to Nathaniel's point earlier, they want to build these data centers for sure.
I think that's a perfect summary. And just, you know, as I cover industrials, I'd make one extra point, which is that the data center queue to try to get access to power is crowding out other industry in some cases. You know, the U.S. is very focused right now on critical minerals and incentivizing that. But if you're trying to build an aluminum smelter or a copper smelter, you have to fight against data centers to get access to power supply. So we're seeing ripple effects throughout the industrial economy.
Are there certain geographical locations, I imagine this is true, that are better than others for these data center buildouts? You know, flat land versus mountainous. And what if you're in a bad area? Does that mean you're just going to have more latency?
Proximity to power is the number one thing that we are finding. Good, accessible proximity to power and the other infrastructure that's available. It's interesting because from an impact perspective, data centers don't impact our schools. They don't impact the traffic on our roads. They have a really high tax benefit for us. And so when you're thinking about location, it's really just about the proximity to power, from my understanding. Mm-hmm.
I would 100% agree. In fact, as I said earlier, I would say, you know, the top priorities, maybe top five, are power, power. And then we're moving on to 6 through 10. They'll basically go anywhere. I mean, when you realize how much heat these generate, you would say, like, why on earth would they develop a data center in Texas? But we're seeing a tremendous amount of data center development. So it's, you know, sort of anywhere you can get power for sure.
I think that's a great segue to my next question, which would be about the developers. So what the developers are looking for perhaps is power, power, power. But who is making the most money in the data center ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal question. So to that point, and linking with power, these data centers are generating revenue from their uptime. you know, losing an hour of power or having downtime for whatever reason can cost $1 million of revenue. So, you know, figuring all this out is really the job of the developers, you know, finding the land, getting the zoning, finding access to power. It's kind of a Herculean task for each one of these projects. But when we kind of break down the bill of materials, if you want to look at it that way, for data center construction, who's really benefiting from all of this? Certainly at the top of the list are the companies supplying the actual IT equipment. So chip makers making the GPUs and CPUs and memory, servers, networking equipment, et cetera. All those together are actually around 80% of the cost of building a data center. And then beyond that, you know, the electrical equipment is next. These are things like uninterruptible power supplies, diesel generators, switchgear, thermal management, very important. All of those together, it's a great opportunity for the suppliers, but it's about 10% of a data center's cost. And then the remainder really goes to companies working on the shell of the building, if you want to call it that. So engineering and construction contractors, installation labor. But all of those are pretty attractive areas to play in, you know, very scarce resources and across all those categories.
Well, when we think about other sources of power, you know, why are some of those other alternative power sources maybe not the best choice here, whether it's solar or wind?
Look, I would say they are very useful additions to the system. You know, the challenge with wind is and solar is they're what we call coincident technologies, which mean they generate power when the sun shines and the wind blows, and we factually know that doesn't happen 24/7. So they're great additions to an existing system. I mean, I think you really have to sort of understand that an electric system is a combination of resources. It's very unlike if you think of your cell phone where you have a battery. And when that battery is dead, you recharge it. Here, an electric system, you know, probably has, I'm thinking the Southeast in particular, has some nuclear, then maybe has a little bit of coal remaining, has some natural gas. And some of that natural gas is combined cycle, it's base load, but some of it's peaking, so it spins up. And the other thing to recognize is electricity supply and demand has to be met. They have to equal one another sort of every second, or really quite frankly, every millisecond. So you have to be spinning up supply as demand rises. So, you know, those solar and wind resources are great, and they're actually very inexpensive. It's just they're not what we call dispatchable. We can't turn them on when the data center says, I want power, or even any one of us in our home. You know, we go home, we turn on the air conditioning, we start cooking dinner. That's increasing our demand. You know, we can't, none of us would want to say, well, no, you can't really have that right now because the sun's going down, so you can't. So I think they're great augments to an existing system. They're just not the solution. We like to say, you know, it's going to take all of the above. You know, you built in the Southeast some new nuclear, building new gas. We're going to build solar and wind, maybe a little more solar than wind, but the reality is you're going to build all and need all of these to meet the demand that's coming.
So the electric grid as it stands today is going to be able to generate what percentage of the demand you're all seeing? Is there a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the grid is very resilient. I mean, I would say, you know, at a very basic level, I mean, the grid, the U.S. electricity grid is a modern day marvel. You know, the idea that, you know, it meets our supply and demand, like we are amazed and quite frankly dismayed when we plug something in and it doesn't work, or the light doesn't come on. We take it for granted, I would argue, and I have, not for this forum, you know, that we undervalue the value of electricity when it allows us to do so many things. So I think the grid is really very resilient and it's ready for this task. I've also said, though, that, you know, the rising amount of demand is really going to test this grid, because, you know, we've historically seen demand grow very slowly. And so if you look out at slow growth over 10 years, you know, any local utility can say, oh, I see I need to add a power plant in 3 years, and I'll start talking to, you know, some of the companies that need to supply me, and I can reasonably get that built. And every the challenge right now is demand is growing so fast, so you're having to regulate the amount of demand you allow on the system, which is then causing these hyperscalers to say, well, I'm going to go do what would otherwise be unnatural things. I'm going to go build behind the meter generation. I really want to connect to the utility. I can't connect to the utility because they can't serve me. And so I'm going to do something until they can. But I would say the grid needs investment. It's certainly aging. I definitely agree with that. But there is an ongoing amount of investment in it. The real wrinkle is the rapidly growing demand, not something fundamentally wrong with the grid, though, again, it is older and needs more investment. I think the challenge always is we need to keep in mind that someone has to pay for those upgrades. And the great part now is AI hyperscalers are creating demand that will pay for a lot of that expansion. But ultimately, you know, no utility is in the business just to, you know, invest and not get a return on capital. So it does, all of these things are a tension that needs to be managed. But ultimately, the AI hyperscalers, I think, can provide a lot of the capital and funding to meet that.
Is that consistent with what you're hearing locally as well, Bridget?
It is. And I was also thinking about the who stands to make the most money. Someone who's selling their land and knows that they're selling it to someone who intends to develop a data center on it, their land value just went up significantly. When you start to look at when people know who they're building for and what they're building for, that changes things. Incentives aside, there's also a lot for local governments to gain from the tax base that they get from this particular user. So there's still a lot to be gained. It's just figuring out the best way to do it. And we're continuously hearing that the approach that like our local power company is taking is you have to pay a non-refundable $100,000 fee to have a study done to start exploring whether or not power is available to you. It's weeding out all the people who are just doing this sort of rogue. I'm trying to think of another way to say it. Just trying to figure out how to do it. It's really narrowing it down to the hyperscalers. And I don't know, are you all seeing that in other states where the power companies are expecting an investment?
Absolutely. I mean, they're, to your point, requiring a fee, but even more than that in due diligence, you know, look to the number that Nathaniel mentioned earlier, 200 gigawatts, the amount of sort of backlog that is in most of the RTOs is probably almost double that. But we also know not all of that will be developed. And so things like large fees and, you know, other take or pay type contract terms are how the utilities are trying to manage to make sure that demand. The worst thing you could possibly do would be to say, absolutely, you can join our system. We'll provide you a gigawatt of power. And then that demand never shows up. And who's left on the hook? You know, it's really not going to be the utility. The utility pledges their assets to public use. It's going to be all the other customers. So what the utility needs to do is to make sure they get an ironclad with lots of, you know, very, very strong counterparty credit agreements that says, yes, this person or entity is going to meet this obligation. And that, you know, is one of the ways they do it.
When we think about community impact, I guess it's not just power, right? We're also hearing about water, noise. Maybe we could just take a minute and dispel how much of that is actually true versus what's just myth.
Well, some of it is true, but it's based on the type of data centers they were building years ago, not what they're doing today. So in terms of water consumption, we have closed loop systems that were not part of their original infrastructure. So it's more of a circulating and recycling water usage. It doesn't have the same impact on environment that the earlier data centers. It's the same thing with the technology related to the generators and how often the generators aren't running all of the time with a constant hum. So they're trying to isolate what were issues of the past and address them with the technology of how we're building today.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of base your facts and base your information on what's happening today, not what was done in the past.
That's great, because I think what we're all seeing on TV is a lot of misinformation. And so that's creating a lot of fear that what I'm hearing from the three of you doesn't necessarily need to be part of the equation.
Well, as we look forward, maybe can we think about where investors can expect their returns to come in future data center projects? Is it the materials? Is it the electrical components that will make up the grid that support that? Is it the land? Where do you all see the next big investment opportunity?
Maybe I can kick off. I think there are, as you alluded to, a few different layers to this. There are a lot of participants throughout the value chain trying to grab a piece. There are, of course, the hyperscalers themselves, which are committing a massive amount of capital under the assumption that AI will eventually be an incredible revenue driver, but still a little early in the build out to see that related revenue fully. From the industrial perspective, which is where, closest to home for me, the companies that are supplying the equipment and services to data centers are growing revenues at, call it 20% plus annual rates in those lines of business. And new order growth from the data centers is up triple digit percentages year over year in many cases. But as we've talked about, there are a rotating cast of bottlenecks keeping a lid on how fast that build out can happen. So I'd say it's more about an elongating duration of compounding growth rather than something that's skyrocketing on the equipment side. But, maybe I pass to Jay for comments on the utilities.
Okay. Yeah. For the utilities, we're seeing accelerating investment in rate base. Recognize the utilities in the Southeast are regulated rather traditionally on a rate base times rate of return investment scheme. So they invest in essentially utility infrastructure and they earn a return on that. And the more investment they have to make, which is sort of the thing we're seeing right now, it's driving earnings growth for them. So utilities, which historically have been slow growth, sort of in line with demand growth, are seeing, accelerating earnings growth as a result of this demand growth. It depends on where you are in the country, but, we are seeing the Southeast and South Central, including Texas, being some of the areas we're seeing some of the fastest growth, and that drives earnings growth for these companies.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Jay. In closing, I thought it would be helpful just to kind of recap the investment opportunity. Because UBS has this proprietary power and resources portfolio, Nathaniel, I thought if you could just review that at a high level without getting into the specifics necessarily, but the opportunity you've all laid out nicely, how does an investor listening to our podcast start to consider this as an investment?
Absolutely. So, to tie it together with the great points in the conversation today, we're really at a true inflection point in electricity demand net of efficiencies that we really haven't seen for decades. And it's not just data centers. It overlaps with building electrification, industrial automation, electric vehicle adoption, as Jay mentioned, the aging grids in developed markets, but also the new build out of emerging market power infrastructure. And when we tie it all together, we think there's about $32 trillion of spending on electrical infrastructure globally over the next decade. Data centers are absolutely one of the fastest growing parts of the opportunity, but we would argue that it's only a fraction of the diverse wave of investment that's happening. So as you mentioned, to capitalize on this generational opportunity in the power investment cycle, we have a power and resources strategy that UBS's chief investment office oversees, which we think is one of the key transformational innovation opportunities that should drive equity returns over time. So we track this global opportunity very closely. And I would say that even though we've all heard a lot about the need for power in this cycle, the investment opportunity here is likely much greater magnitude and longer duration than investors appreciate today.
I think what's interesting about it too, Nathaniel, is how it's not necessarily correlated to AI. I know maybe early on it sort of traded that way, but these are very, very different components of the entire, system, if you will. And I think it's an interesting way to invest more tangentially maybe to that theme, that AI theme.
Yes, very much so. It just simply takes a long time to build electrical infrastructure, mm-hmm. to figure out who's going to pay for it, to build these contracts. It's a very complex process that likely takes years to decades to play out. So we think it's a phenomenal opportunity over the medium to long term as well.
Great. Thank you. I'd love to get your comment. Each of you have like one closing comment about our conversation today that you think would help, people listening to the podcast to further understand, the magnitude of what we're talking about and the opportunity. and kind of dispelling some of the fear. So Bridget, I'll start with you.
I'm thinking about it, and from the perspective of there are so many opportunities, I think as fast as this is happening, it still takes a relative amount of patience. Mm-hmm. To his point, it's not going to happen quickly.
And your boots on the ground in front of city council, so you are a part of the conversations here. So you have a real sense of the speed, at least locally, in what's happening.
I think saying like government and speed is a little bit of an oxymoron, right? So it's going to take a little while for everyone to figure out how it works best in each community.
Yes.
But it's not lost on anybody that the demand is incredibly high. The opportunities are there. It's just figuring out the how, and that might take a little bit of time.
Nathaniel Jay.
Yeah, you know, on my end, I would kind of follow on to that and just say that it feels like the world, and particularly the investment community, is trying to look through to the end of this cycle. That, you know, is it this year? Is it next year? Is it 2028? And because of the bottlenecks that are slowing the build out, you know, I don't think we're likely to get significantly overcapacitized in the near term. I think this is something that will take a significant amount of time, likely longer than investors appreciate. And that, I would argue, the slow pace of progress is probably a good thing for the duration of the opportunity.
Yeah, and I'd end sort of mirroring both of those. I mean, look, as Nathaniel said, building generation, you know, electric generation takes a long time. I mean, in the Southeast, you guys felt that it took 10 years to build, you know, the most recent nuclear power plant in the state of Georgia that was built in the United States. These things take time. But the reality is, and I'll say on a personal basis, you know, I use AI every day, and I think it's amazing. I think Bridget put it best, you know, this is real, it's big demand, and it's coming. I think what we have to do, you know, very locally, is manage the impact of that. But as best I can tell, you know, the people with the biggest shoulders behind this, the AI hyperscalers and data center developers, are very, very keen to make sure that they're, you know, paying their fair share. So this is something, if, you know, sort of properly regulated and overseen, actually should be a net benefit to the communities, or at least most of the communities that it is developed in.
Well, you all are fantastic. This has been a great discussion. Don't be surprised if we call you to ask you come back in a couple of months and just update us. But thank you all for your time today. I think it's been a great discussion. So on behalf of Leslie and myself, we appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.